Investable Universe is about thematic topics in real assets investing. This is what we mean by the global market of things: real estate, infrastructure, land, energy, and other commodities that have historically been viewed as boring old income investments. But take a look at the shifts underway in these asset classes, from industry disruptors to new investors to emerging markets to geopolitics, and you'll find these assets are very interesting. We'll talk about private equity, venture capital, corporate VC, sovereign wealth funds, listed markets, crazy startups, some old guard investment firms, some maverick entrepreneurs, and some paradigm-shifting technologies. One thing is certain, no corner of the global market of things will be left untouched by the changes happening right now, and that's what we talk about on this podcast. Okay. Earlier this spring, a controversial rare earth metals mining project proposed in Greenland thrust what might otherwise have been considered a kitchen table economic issue for the island to the very center of the geopolitical stage. A snap election was called over whether to mine critical metals at the site called Kvænefjeld, an election that resulted in a clear no vote from the Greenlandic people and ended decades of rule by the dominant Siumut party. It is fair to say that this was a no heard round the world, ushering in a new coalition government led by the Inuit Ataqatigiit and Nalraq parties and a new approach to self-determination and natural resource management for Greenland as it asserts its newly super strategic role in the Arctic, a cold region hotly contested. For this Investable Universe series on investing in Arctic real assets, I am joined by the individual who will be leading Greenland's government efforts in these areas, Minister of Foreign Affairs, Trade, Business, and Climate, Pelle Broberg. Thank you for speaking with Investable Universe today.
Of course, my pleasure.
So let's get started here. When many American news followers first became aware of Greenland's snap election this spring, it was framed in the context of the Kvænefjeld mining project. So the hazards of mining rare earth metals and uranium from that site, maybe the ownership of the Greenland Minerals Company that was hoping to get a concession for that site. Suddenly, this issue became a late cycle election spoiler. Can you maybe walk our listeners through what happened in Greenland, broadly speaking, in the run-up to the election, which led to the first government party change in Greenland in many decades?
Yes, of course. It's no secret that my chairman of our political party has been the chairman of Siumut and also been the prime minister of Greenland for several years, Hans Enoksen. Hans Enoksen is a stout defender of Inuit rights and also sustainable mining practices. So when we look back at the previous years, I think it was 2014, when a much disputed vote took place in the parliament, where Siumut, until now, has had the majority, they removed our barrier for mining uranium. We had a zero tolerance policy up until then. It wasn't written anywhere, but they nevertheless needed to vote in parliament to remove the zero tolerance for uranium. And this vote was done with 16 for, 15 against, which means it's a very close parliament decision. And this resulting confusion up till now has been that the mining company, Greenland Minerals, has had an exploration license where they are not guaranteed to get a utilization license. And this is one of the few things that are coming up either later this year or next year that a decision has to be made, which also called for the snap election, because a lot of people did not agree with the status of the project. And they wanted a clarification of what are we going to do about open pit mining of uranium with very few resources being allocated to the Inuit population. So the background is quite complicated, but the end result this spring was quite clear. There was overwhelming majority against open pit mining of uranium in Greenland, which you can see both in the national election as well as the municipal election, where Siumut, for the first time, I think, ever, lost the majority of the municipality in the southern part of Greenland, where this mining project is located. So there is not a broad consensus amongst the population for uranium mining, but there is a broad consensus that we need to look at ways to both attract investment as well as making money in Greenland in general.
So just for purpose of clarification for our listeners, when you talk about open pit mining of uranium, is this uranium a byproduct of rare earth metals mining, or is it uranium for as a separate commodity?
Well, it depends on the eyes that are looking at the project, I guess. I'm not an expert on this. And as I mentioned earlier, my purview as a foreign minister is not the mineral projects itself. But many people regard uranium as a byproduct, as mining of uranium.
Okay.
So I think the amounts are 500 tons, metric tons a year with the proposed mining, which in... it was in the whole scale, I cannot remember precisely, is why the reason why they have so much against it. It has nothing to do with rare earth minerals, but uranium.
Ah, okay. So generally speaking, do you think that the Greenlandic people felt that they had been deceived by the nature of the Greenland Minerals project, or even of the company itself? I mean, it's called Greenland Minerals, but as I understand, it is an Australian-owned company that has got a minority investment from a Chinese company that may or may not have ties to the Chinese government, and that might have been a little unclear in a way that was very uncomfortable to Greenlandic voters. Is that what's your take on that?
My take on it is that I think it was the politicians who did not take into account that the population as a general is not for uranium mining.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with Greenland Minerals itself, ownership or whatnot. But one of the facts that the politicians have overlooked a quite important part of our legislation that Denmark has put in was that we have to concede a lot of our income from mining companies to Denmark when they exceed more than 75 million Danish kroner, which is approximately $11 to $13 million a year in revenue, in profit to the government agreement. If we exceed that, Denmark gets half, which means that there's no... We are not following the United Nations Resolution 1514 in that regards. So I'm not quite sure if it's legal, but this is what a lot of politicians also forgot when they looked at the income, proposed income to the government agreement when they looked at this project. And I think during this election, it dawned on a lot of people that, oh, we are not getting $1 billion out of this. We're getting a half at most out of it over the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm. So what is the status of that mining project right now? I mean, your government has drawn a firm line, no uranium, but what is the project being renegotiated? Can you talk about the status as of right now?
As I said before, the individual project is not under my purview, but I think what has been publicly announced by the Minister of Minerals so far is that they're not expecting to allocate any license to Greenland Minerals for the Kvanerøy, as it's called in Greenland, project.
Mm-hmm. And so is there an official position of the government on any, I mean, you've mentioned sort of the undesirability maybe of this arrangement with Denmark where you have to share these profits with them above a certain threshold. There's been, you know, the issue of the uranium and whether that was, whether that was made clear to voters prior to talks reaching a fairly advanced level. Is there an official position for the Greenlandic government on any extractive mining investment or any natural resource investment that a company might want to pursue in Greenland in the coming years? Like maybe this is... Okay, you've seen what just happened with Kvanefjeld. Any other investors want to come in? These are the rules you're going to have to abide by.
No, I think what investors in general should be aware of is making sure that you involve the local population, that mm-hmm. they feel heard in what you're proposing to do. Mm-hmm. And one thing that is quite important to underscore is that Greenlanders have a different way of understanding things. You will often meet a lot of Danes running businesses in Greenland. And by communicating with them, expect that this will be the general consensus by Greenlanders.
Uh-huh.
That is typically not the case. So you have to make sure you're not just meeting Danish people living up here and working with companies. You have to get involved with the local communities and the Greenlanders to make sure that they understand the project you are investing in. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you get past that threshold, getting in contact with the Greenlanders, mm-hmm. There should be quite easy to expand on mining operations in Greenland.
Mm-hmm. So now the rare earth metals have been in focus recently because they're strategically important given all these emerging technologies. There's attention given to Greenland's extraordinary resources in terms of gemstones, et cetera. But for many years, Greenland was in focus as a potential site for offshore oil drillers, and that's what I recall from my years of living in Denmark, was that there was a great deal of exploration activity. And I'm just wondering how Greenland, in your view, how Greenland's experience in dealing with offshore oil companies and these kind of E&P contracts, whether they really panned out to anything or not, how has that shaped the government's policy or its view toward private investment in natural resources generally? What lessons were taken away from that experience?
I think it's quite important to underscore that one thing we are working for as a majority in the parliament, as well as the government, is we keep calling it independence, mm-hmm. but it's actually decolonization.
Yeah.
So when you look at United Nations Resolution 1514, mm-hmm. one of the things that we are doing is making our own mistakes and learning from them.
Right.
Back when Cairn Energy was in Greenland exploring for oil, mm-hmm. as well as Shell and BP, others were looking for oil as well. One of the things we did not take into account was the effects on what if we found anything.
Yeah.
How will we produce this? How will we export this? How will this affect the local communities? This is some things I think that has been reinforced, especially with the Gwadnilsøy project, Kvanefjeld project, mm-hmm. that we cannot start open pit mining near cities. Where, mm-hmm. or inhabited areas, where they will affect both our production of livestock as well as the livelihood of fisheries and stuff like that, mm-hmm. in nearby communities. So I think one of the things that we are looking at is how do we do this in a smart way to mm-hmm. ensure that these vast areas that is called Greenland, it's the world's biggest island, mm-hmm. with the ice melting, revealing more and more minerals. How do we make sure that we can make investments in Greenland, make it an investable place, mm-hmm. as well as a political stable country where you can actually expect to get a return on your investment? Mm-hmm. So when you look at it from our point of view, we are trying to make broad coalition decisions, which means that even though we are a majority government, we are looking at ways to include the opposition, including Siumut, mm-hmm. so as to, if there is a change in power later on, we won't have a reversal of policies like we just had now. Mm-hmm. And again, this goes back to the decision of removing the zero tolerance policy with one vote majority. Mm-hmm. We are trying to look at how can we make this a broad coalition agreement. Of course, no guarantees that we can make it that, but we are looking at ways to do that.
Is your government concerned about relying too heavily on commodity exports? I mean, that is sort of that is the potential curse of countries that are, that are blessed with a lot of commodity resources. They call it the Dutch disease, right? If you become, there's a certain distortion in not only international relations, but in economic relationships that result from a country or an economy relying too exclusively on commodities. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, if you look, again, I have to point out that we have been a colony up until, some would say, 1953, I would argue, mm-hmm. to this day, mm-hmm. Where we have a monopoly line going to Denmark. Mm-hmm. All our goods are going to Denmark. We are exporting fish. All our seafood products goes to Denmark. Mm-hmm. A few of them through Iceland to other places. But we are indeed relying on a single export commodity, which is seafood, mm-hmm. and all of them going to one port, which is Denmark. Mm-hmm. So we don't even look at the minerals as a way to be careful of a single export mm-hmm. Value chain. We are looking at supplementing our seafood export and also diversifying our seafood export lines, among other things, to United Kingdom and United States, mm-hmm. and other countries, of course. So we are actually trying to learn from how did we do it previously, yeah. and how would we not like to proceed. We are not interested in continuing the old colonial ways, which mm-hmm. we're actually trying to follow United Nations Resolution 1514 mm-hmm. and working for independence, and also means working with more and more countries.
So just a follow-up with regard to UN Resolution 1514, does Greenland have any international legal recourse against Denmark in terms of maybe revisiting this colonial-style relationship?
Well, one of the interesting things is that there's a book that has been published recently. It's called In Danish Imperialist Børn, which is The Children of the Empire, mm-hmm. Which actually showed how Denmark, this is based on factual letters and factual mm-hmm. Official papers in the Danish ministries, mm-hmm. how they actually forced Greenlanders, a few of them during a period of 3 days, to sign a declaration that saying that they wanted to join the Kingdom of Denmark, mm-hmm. and also manipulated the United Nations into thinking that Greenlanders wanted to become part of Denmark, instead of giving Greenland the three obligatory choices: full independence, free association, or becoming a part of the mm-hmm. colonial powers. So one of the interesting things is that history tends to either repeat itself or reveal itself. Mm-hmm. And I think the coming time will be quite important for us to figure out how do we want to proceed from here on in, mm-hmm. and also how will the international community react to the book's publishing,
yeah.
when they see how the United Nations was, let's just call it, was duped.
Yeah. So when you share this story, let's say, with Greenland's counterparts in the global arena, what's their reaction?
Well, I haven't had the chance to share these news because I just got the book yeah. itself 3 days ago.
Okay,
I'm still amazed of what they're revealing in it,
yeah.
and I have requested copies of the original letters that are the basis for the book. Mm-hmm. But I have talked with some of our Icelandic colleagues with regards to the. To this book, and mm-hmm. one of them, Gudmundur Alfredsson, has mm-hmm. also done a thesis on it. He has a PhD in this, mm-hmm. and he also pointed out the same things in mm-hmm. 2000, I think, 3 or 4. So he wasn't surprised to see that others had uncovered the mm-hmm. documentation behind a behavior he had described previously. Mm-hmm. But much of it is still news to us, and we're still trying to digest what's in them mm-hmm. and what the ramification will be.
So let's talk about another geopolitical relationship that is taking shape in the Arctic, and that is the relationships with Russia, particularly in light of Russia's new chairmanship of the Arctic Council. How is Greenland managing any diplomatic fault lines, so to speak, between Russia and, let's say, the U.S.? Do you find that a difficult balancing act in this? No, not at all.
Not at all. Russia is, I think, the single biggest Arctic state in the Arctic Council.
Yep.
Greenland is entirely in the Arctic. Mm-hmm. We have Russia as a neighbor. We have Russia as a trading partner. We have a lot of relations with Russians in our daily days, if you can call it like that, when you look at commerce. What we have not seen is an attempt by anybody to stop our peaceful talks. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we only seen encouragement to say, let's ensure that the Arctic is a low tension area. Mm-hmm. And this can only be accomplished by diplomatic relations, talks. Mm-hmm. So we have not experienced any kind of I don't know if I should call it problems or challenges with Russia. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we are looking forward to working with them in the Arctic Council mm-hmm. over the coming years as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned an interest in maintaining the Arctic as a low tension area. Do you think is it realistic to suppose that neutrality, so to speak, can be maintained in the Arctic region, given the nature of the developments that are taking place there. I mean, the shipping routes, the minerals, the commodities, the climate change, the defense technology, et cetera. I mean, is it realistic to suppose that this sort of idyllic low tension relationship can be maintained?
Let me rephrase your question to another part.
Okay.
We talk about climate change. Mm-hmm. We are in the coming years, and also when we are participating at COP26 in Scotland later this year, we'll be showing some of our concrete steps to help combat climate change. Mm-hmm. If nobody wants to take any steps towards combating climate change, we won't achieve anything. Mm-hmm. And Greenland, as an Arctic state, has loudly declared in this coalition agreement, mm-hmm. we want to be demilitarized. That has nothing to do with the U.S. presence, for instance,
okay.
but it has something to do with how we conduct our daily lives. Mm-hmm. We don't need military vessels to do fisheries inspection, to mm-hmm. do search and rescue. We can do it with a Coast Guard, for instance, like the U.S. Coast Guard, the mm-hmm. Icelandic Coast Guard. We have a lot of different Coast Guards placed around the world, and we want to have a changeover to a thinking of civilian capacities instead of military capacities. Mm-hmm. This has without still surrendering our borders, if you call it like that. Mm-hmm. But when we look at military standpoint, Greenland does not have any armed forces, mm-hmm. and we have no intentions about it. But that doesn't mean we are not protected. Mm-hmm. We still have a defense agreement with the United States through Denmark. Mm-hmm. So when we look at it from our point of view, it's very important to say we want to do our small part to ensure stability, mm-hmm. which means giving up on military hardware, but relying on civilian hardware to ensure surveillance, search and rescue, sovereignty control, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But if nobody wants to do it, of course, then we will be the only ones. But still, it's the same as combating the climate changes. If nobody wants to take the first step, we aren't getting anywhere. Mm-hmm. So we just want to contribute and do our part to ensure a low tension politically as well as financially stable Arctic.
Now, how do the Greenlandic people feel about the U.S. Military, the traditional U.S. military presence through, for example, the Thule Air Base? You mentioned that Greenland has a defense agreement with the United States through Denmark. But how do the Greenlandic people feel about that U.S. defense relationship? And what's the status of it right now?
I think we have three parts to that question. First, everybody agrees that there's a good idea to keep the U.S. presence in Greenland. Mm-hmm. The second part is that some of it is based on mistrust with regards to the history, because people tend to think that the U.S. has done something bad towards Greenlanders in the past, mm-hmm. which is not true. It's the Danes. If you look at when they moved the Qaanaaq population from Dundas to Qaanaaq, when they forcefully removed them, it wasn't the Americans. Well, it was a wish to establish an embassy there, but it was the Danes who moved them. Mm-hmm. When you look at sort of all the different things that has become public knowledge since then, it has always been the Danes that has been doing unfair things to Greenlanders. So based off of that, there's some mistrust that who will gain what of the military presence. Mm-hmm. But despite that mistrust, they still try to figure out how can we get something out of it for the country, for the benefit mm-hmm. of the Greenlandic people. Mm-hmm. And then there's the third part, which is afraid of U.S. military greater engagement in the rest of the Greenland. Mm-hmm. And to that, I have to say, most of it is based on what U.S. in the history has done previously to indigenous peoples, mm-hmm. which is, I think, a thing of the past. Mm-hmm. I do not experience the same attitude towards Greenlanders mm-hmm. as some of them claim they have. I have experienced nothing but cooperation and collaboration mm-hmm. with the US. So I think with more enlightenment, better sharing of information, I think most people will be quite satisfied with having a defense agreement with the United States in the future, also when we are independent from Denmark.
Mm-hmm. And how, you know, I mean, we've discussed here on multiple, you know, multiple points here, points of contention with Denmark, and that Greenland is trying to extract itself from, I mean, you are undergoing a process of decolonization. And there are revelations in this new book, Imperius Burnt, that are, you know, that are going to surprise people and maybe a real rude awakening, let's say, for people both in, you know, maybe perhaps not for Greenland, but certainly for Denmark. How do you see the relationship with Denmark evolving in the near future? I mean, it's, you know, it's, there's, you know, we can, people talk about maybe, you know, history is a thing of the past. Look, the crown prince couple gave their children the Greenlandic middle names. Isn't that nice that we're all a happy family? Is that, how do you see this relationship evolving in a way that is acceptable and dignified for Greenland?
Well, I think one of the most important things is that we cannot speak for other countries and their intentions. Mm-hmm. If history has learned us anything, powers will try to stay in power. Mm-hmm. So if you look at it from our point of view, I have no assumption about what Denmark will do or won't do. Mm-hmm. But what I am looking for is trying to figure out how can we move forward together. Mm-hmm. Which is, again, brings me back to Resolution 1514, mm-hmm. because if only Denmark in 1953 had done it the right thing, I'm quite sure we would be where we are today or something looking like it. Mm-hmm. But the problem is they didn't. So going forward, I think one of the main drivers for Denmark, I think, will be that they're quite good at doing what's morally right. Mm-hmm. They're not afraid of making difficult decisions for the Danish people. And if you look at the, even though people tend to think that Denmark is clinging to Greenland, I don't think it's true. If you look at Iceland, they I don't want to say got away from the Danish kingdom, but they were peacefully allowed to break away as well. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for a future where we actually can take it step by step. And mm-hmm. one of the things I have personally or politically proposed during the election and before that was a free association agreement mm-hmm. with Denmark. That's still with Denmark. Mm-hmm. Well, and provided they are interested in it, of course. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm saying it is because we have a self-rule law mm-hmm. where free association is actually described. And in order for us to make utilize a free association agreement, well, then UN Resolution 1514 has to be in place, and also mm-hmm. Resolution 1541, as well as 26. Mm-hmm. In short, mm-hmm. Denmark has already written in the options to include a free association agreement as well as a full independency from Denmark if we decide to. So I don't foresee a difficulty in our coming of age and becoming independent in the future. I think it will be a maturing into a free association agreement that either can or cannot last until if we come fully independent from Denmark. But again, I think the relationships between our countries are good enough that it can survive us not being part of the Kingdom of Denmark, but mm-hmm. being a state that is associated with the Kingdom of Denmark.
So apropos of free associations, do you see the Arctic region speaking with a unified voice in matters of Arctic development, or are new bilateral relationships, maybe newly strengthened bilateral alliances taking place within the region, for example, between Greenland and Iceland? It seems to me there's some simpatico. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier that the snap election in Greenland this past spring was decided, came down to the very narrowest of margins. And so the coalition government is now taking, you know, extraordinary steps to try to ensure that there's broad-based consensus, etc. But can you describe the political tone for our listeners who are probably not in Greenland right now? Describe the domestic political tone in Greenland's government right now. Where do Nalraq and IA, Inuit Ataqatigiit, stand on the political spectrum compared to Siumut? And what is the unifying theme there?
Well, one of the things that you have to remember is that Inuit Ataqatigiit and Nalraq has mm-hmm. been in opposition together for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the main reasons why we had so easy a task of collaborating, even though we're two different parties, is that we share some of the same goals. We want mm-hmm. independence for Greenland, mm-hmm. and we want a strengthening of our identity, mm-hmm. Which is the Inuit. And we are also looking at it from a practical point of view, that we don't want to sell out of our country for short-term monetary gains. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the political spectrum, then Inuit Ataqatigiit is on the far left, mm-hmm. With Nalraq, depending on the issue, either being extremely the most liberal party or in the middle. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm saying like that is that because as a liberal party, we have always said it cannot be on the expense of the people. Mm-hmm. So when we make decisions in a liberal point of pointing us in a liberal direction, it has to benefit us, not mm-hmm. be detrimental to the majority of the population. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Siumut, they are a little bit more to the right of the spectrum mm-hmm. in general, which is also where you can see that the incoming inequality has risen dramatically during their tenure. Mm-hmm. So Inuit Ataqatigiit is much more socialistic mm-hmm. oriented, where Nalraq is more in the middle mm-hmm. with a liberal, let's call it, bias.
Yeah. So you are one of, correct me if I'm wrong, you're one of two members of Nalraq in the government cabinet right now. Is that right? Okay. And so, yet you have, I would argue, possibly the highest profile and certainly one of the most globally influential cabinet positions. What does that say about the role of Nalraq in the coalition? Is that sort of that your party is sort of acknowledged as the portfolio spokespeople for foreign policy in Greenland?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I think one of the main reasons you have to look at history, as I said, yeah. Our chairman, Hans Enoksen, he has been the chairman of both Siumut and mm-hmm. the premier or prime minister of Greenland for that party. So last time when we briefly ventured into a coalition with Siumut, I was also given the very heavy post of the Ministry of Finance. Mm-hmm. That was my first political job ever. So it says volumes about how people want to work with not just me, but our party. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm not sitting in the finance ministry this time is a combination of they have a capable person of taking care of that department, of course, but also because we can see a lot of the interest for Greenland requires a different active foreign policy capable person. Mm-hmm. Which means that with my history with an international business specialization, as well as having had multiple businesses myself mm-hmm. and having been a commercial pilot for, yep. I think, the better part of 20 years, mm-hmm. That was a choice I was given if I wanted that post mm-hmm. By Inuit Ataqatigiit, of course, because we had coalition agreements, of course. Mm-hmm. And I have accepted that and have worked very closely with our Prime Minister, Mucci Bobil, mm-hmm. Because one of the main reasons we are working so well together is that we don't look at party differences. Mm-hmm. We look at the long-term goals for Greenland. Mm-hmm. And we're also trying to actively involve the opposition. We, of course, it's no easy feat. Yeah. We'll just look at the bipartisan politics, that how few of them are succeeding in the U.S. or anywhere else. But we're trying. We're trying.
Yeah. On the back of that, on that question, I mean, so your ministerial portfolio is foreign affairs, industry, trade, and climate. That, I mean, any one of those is probably a full-time job in Greenland right now, plus. Have all of those policy areas traditionally been held by just one cabinet minister, or so this is new, that this is an amalgamated portfolio. So aren't you special?
Again, I have to revert back to, this is not just something we have required or asked for. Anything. Mm-hmm. We have had talks where we tried to figure out if we wanted to get synergy effects from our visibility in the world and actually try to come about change, mm-hmm. then we have to stop asking between ministries and all, how can we do this? And here's a request for that. So we're trying to keep them in one, mm-hmm. and which is also why I said it is a heavy post I've been given, but we still collaborate on, despite the different departments, but it is a heavy post for sure.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that you have a background prior to entering politics. You have a background in international business. You were a commercial pilot for almost 20 years. As an experienced pilot, what can you say about needs for investment in Greenland's transportation infrastructure in the coming years?
Oh, geez. Well, we have our biggest infrastructure project up for review this, I think, Friday. Mm-hmm. So I would be careful about thinking too much about the airport projects until the parliament has decided how to proceed.
Okay.
But one of the things that you should be careful with is looking too much of, if you do this, then we can do this. Okay. I think operators, being a commercial airline, ships operators, crew sailors, freight operators, they should look at our current infrastructure and say, how can we utilize this? Because then it's much easier for us to actually say, okay, we will look at your request and actually try to see if we can accommodate it. For instance, we have Kangerlussuaq Airport, former Sondrestrom Air Force Base, where Secretary Blinken visited Greenland. Mm-hmm. It has one of the highest regularities in the world, which means that it's very seldom the airport is closed due to something. Mm-hmm. And that is actually located just between Europe and the U.S. Ah. So having been good enough for World War II, as old as other wars as well, as mm-hmm. a stopover, because it's very reliable with the weather and servicing, I think that's one of the things that are very easy to look at and say, how can we utilize this? And we already had a request for data from an American company, but again, we have to supply with what we can, and most of the data we can not supply is commercially from other companies that we are unable to procure. But we are encouraging to look at Greenland as a stopover on the way to Europe.
Uh-huh. You mentioned the visit of Secretary of State Antony Blinken not too many weeks ago. Can you talk about what you discussed with Secretary Blinken, or the nation? Maybe a new, is there a new spirit to the talks between the U.S. and Greenland? I mean, he came into this job in a relatively thankless position, given what we know the U.S. has just experienced over the past 4 years. So, what was your take on your talks with Secretary Blinken?
No. I think most of the world are quite aware of the real estate angle that has been put forth previously. One of the main takeaways that I can say that I interpreted from Secretary Blinken's visit was that he agreed that we shouldn't be a trading object, but a trading partner.
Right.
And for me, that speaks volumes.
Yeah.
And also, one of the things that we are very grateful for, especially in my position, having been responsible for the visit, is that we are all aware of the close relationship between Israel and the U.S. Mm-hmm. And at the time for his visit, there was actually a war or conflict in those parts of the world. And still he found the time to visit Greenland. So it spoke volumes to us that this is something they want to cultivate, that this is a relationship we can build on. So I'm very grateful and thankful for the visit, because it gave us the opportunity to speak about Power to X investments, for instance, how we can invest in green energy, how we can look at the Paris Climate Agreement and perhaps join it with regards to Greenland being an undeveloped nation. Again, I do know that we tend to be looked at as part of Denmark, but we don't have the same living conditions as in Denmark. So when we look at the Paris Climate Agreement and the option for helping undeveloped countries creating green energy, we are very hopeful that we can actually get outside investments for this.
So if you were to, you know, I don't know, maybe this is a sort of an idealistic question, but if you could mention the number one investment priority for Greenland right now, again, bearing in mind what we've just discussed for the past, you know, half hour plus, that Greenland is a partner, that Greenland is a fully wishes for full and complete self-determination. This is not an objectifying relationship. But if you had an opportunity to direct an outside investment to one part of Greenland, what would it be?
Well, I would direct it to the trade department, because we are not trading with the rest of the world currently, which means that one of the examples I can bring is that when you, whether it be mining industry, whether it being a construction industry, infrastructure projects, everything has the common factor that is, I think, three times the price of doing anything in the US, which means that unless we start trading with other countries other than Denmark, we will continue to have this extreme price differential that the inhabitants of Greenland, the Greenlanders, are paying for. So when if I wanted to direct any sort of attention, it would be to trade, simply just trade, because I tend to illustrate it this way. Despite of one of the expensiest prices, highest prices of construction and living cost in, well, most of the world, probably not true, but that's how we feel. Despite of all that, we are living here. We are thriving in the Arctic. So imagine if we had just a lowering of some of the cost simply by expanding our trading partners, investment partners. Imagine the possibilities that everybody could help create in the Arctic. That's one of the things I would like to promote.
Yeah. So what's your vision for Greenland 5 years from now? I mean, it sounds like you sort of articulated it a little bit, but what if you were going to describe the Greenland you see 5 years from now, given all the, I mean, this is an extraordinary opportunity. I mean, there's been, there's a new government for the first time in many decades. There's a tension, but you have, you know, resources that are going to shape the 21st century and beyond. This is, I mean, this is a unique, you know, jumping off point. Potentially, what's where do you see Greenland in 5 or even, let's say even 10 years from now?
Well, in 5 to 10 years, actually, it's, it makes a difference. I think I would say it this way. This coming decade will be very interesting being a Greenlander, being it independence, being it economic development. There will be a lot of drastic changes in the coming time. And I think one of the things that most people have to ask themselves is, when do I invest in the Arctic and what do I invest in? And I would look at it this way: as long as you can get mobility to and from and internally, if you can get that lowered, you will enhance a lot more mining industries, a lot more seafood production. You will get actually a development in the Arctic that you haven't seen before simply by opening up. So I think you will see a more global-oriented Greenland in the coming time. And actually, that's one of our main goals for having an active foreign policy, is to making sure that we can actually have tangible results for the population with regards to, let's say, construction equipment and building materials. I've given the example to Secretary Blinken that it should be a possibility for a restaurant in New York to serve a fish caught in Greenland that day, or for a lumberjack in the US to go to work, put down the trees, go through a sawmill and have it delivered in Greenland to build our homes. Mm-hmm. We have a need for a two-way street. We are not just looking for exporting to the US. We are looking to import as well, because we have a very high rate of importing basically everything that we need to develop our economy from other places. Currently, it's only Denmark primarily.
So this is these are exciting ideas. I know that our listeners who are predominantly investment oriented or investment interested are going to have this is food for thought and then some. So it's an exciting decade taking place, and I'm so honored to be speaking with you as someone who's got a big hand in making it happen. Pelle Broberg, thank you for speaking with Investable Universe. And one final thing, Imperius Burn. People should read that book when it's available in English. Where can we find it? Who's the author? Do you have it?
I had it just previously.
You had it just previously. Okay.
I had the name. It's Anna Kirstine Hermann.
Anna Kirstine Hermann. Okay.
Anne with two N and E, Kirstine Hermann.
Okay. Anna Kirstine Hermann.
And I only read a third of it, and I'm not going to say I'm appalled. Yeah. That's too strong a word. But I think there will be repercussions as a result of that book. But I cannot speak for the government agreement, but I'm thinking about the readers around the world because of the decolonization, Black Lives Matter, all the movements we see around the world. I think this will have an impact as well. I think it's very well written, and I'm looking to get the originals, copies of the original letters myself.
Ah, well, this is going to be a real eye-opener. I can't wait to read it, and I hope you'll come and speak with us again, maybe as soon as you have some of these major projects underway. It's going to be exciting to follow. Pelle Broberg, thank you so much for speaking with Investable Universe today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we got for Investable Universe this week. If you liked what you heard, share the link, check out the site at investableuniverse.com, or pitch us for future episodes. The address is editor@investableuniverse.com. My name is Rebecca Darst, and you'll hear more from me next time.